So the other day, in a New York Times interview, the legendary Jan Winner, Rolling Stone founder, editor, and kingpin, told a reporter that the men he interviewed for his new book, The Masters, were, quote, kind of philosophers of rock, and that no female musicians were, quote, as articulate enough on this intellectual level as the men. It's not that they're inarticulate, although go have a deep conversation with Grace Slick or Janis Joplin. Please be my guest, he said. You know, Joni Mitchell was not a philosopher of rock and roll. She didn't, in my mind, meet that test. Not by her work, not by the interview she did. He also said of black artists, you know, Stevie Wonder, genius, right? I suppose when you use a word as broad as masters, the fault is using that word. Maybe Marvin Gaye or Curtis Mayfield. I mean, they just didn't articulate at that level. And this, like 100% this, is why diversity in media is so important. Now, as much as ever. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Julie Carrick Dalton, the exceptional novelist and author of The Last Beekeeper and Waiting for the Night Song. This is episode number 329. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right, Julie. First of all, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it. It looks like you're sitting in a prison cell. I'm not going to lie.
My prison cell, my bedroom, whatever you want to call it. My apartment's getting painted, so I'm in a corner of my bedroom.
No disrespect. All right, so I was thinking about this today. In life, everyone is intimidated by someone. In life, when you're coming up and you're young, everyone is intimidated by someone. Even people who we look at now. I mean, John F. Kennedy was intimidated by someone. Donald Trump was intimidated by someone, maybe. Joe Biden was. Everyone's intimidated by someone. The year is 1990, and I'm a freshman at the University of Delaware. And I am just a cocky little fuck who comes up to the Review, the student newspaper at the University of Delaware. And I want to write, and I want to write, and I want to write, and they don't let freshmen write. And I am just cocky, and I think I'm the greatest thing ever. And they let me write, and you were one of the editors there. You wouldn't remember this. You probably wouldn't remember me, but you scared the shit out of me. I considered you, all of you guys, really. But I remember being like, whoa, Julie Carrick, like, you all just seemed so scary and, like, terrifying. And I think maybe I misread that. Is it possible I misread that?
I mean, I don't think I'm scary, but ask my kids. They might have a different opinion. But I do, of course, I remember you. We were on the paper together for a couple of years, I think.
So you and I both worked at the Review, the student newspaper, University of Delaware. We both got on to have careers in writing. And I found that, like, that description, writers who came out of college with us through the years just fades away and fades away and fades away. I don't know if you've noticed this, but, like, it used to be, like, coming out of college, 50 of us went into journalism. And then maybe 10 years later, there'd still be 30. And there'd still be 20. And then there's 10. And then there's basically me, you, and a few other people. Here we sit 30-something years later. You've written multiple books, awards, all this stuff. Like, is it still a viable career to pursue?
Well, that's a tough question. I'd say it's a worthy career to pursue. The finances of it, I don't know. I mean, I know a lot of people kind of went the path that went into communications, you know, corporate communications or PR or something, because journalism's a tough, it's, you know, everything's shrinking. Jobs are getting lost, newspapers are folding. And I don't know about you, but I went through the community newspaper route. Like, I started with really small little papers and worked my way up in journalism. And I loved it. Like, I loved every second. I loved every job I had. I feel like I got like 10 master's degrees over the years and all this, you know, from all the interviews and research. And I'm sure you feel the same way. So I'd say it's a worthy career. I don't know if it's viable anymore, though.
Wait, what was your first newspaper gig?
The Cecil Whig in Elkton, Maryland.
Oh, all right. What's your greatest moment for writing for the Cecil Whig in Elkton, Maryland? I just want to say that was a jump off paper for a decent number of review people through the years, writing for the Cecil Whig in nearby Elkton, Maryland. Correct me if I'm wrong, Maryland, home of the KKK.
Okay, so that was the story I was going to share with you. I interviewed the Grand Dragon of the KKK when I was in Maryland, and he was a very creepy dude. Gosh, I can't remember his name. I feel like his name was Chester.
Chester Doles.
Yes, Chester, exactly. Yes. And I loved that job. I love community journalism. I thought it was great. So that was tough to sit down, sit across the table, a in-person interview with the, you know, the grand dragon or whatever you call it, the grandmaster or whatever you call them. You know, he was, you know, an uncomfortable guy, but yeah, you do that stuff and it, you know, leaves an imprint on you. I also was involved in a, there was a murder case in Elkton that had some like sealed records that someone slipped me and with a wink, wink, nod, nod that like I was involved with kind of exposing the a murder case in there, which I probably wouldn't have been involved in at a big paper at that point in my career. So I had some, you know, I love community journalism.
Wait, we really haven't talked about this. All right. You get out of Delaware, you go to the CISA WIB. What was your hopscotch? Where'd you go?
Okay. So I don't know if you know, remember Sean, he went to Delaware with us. We got married a year and a half out of college and he got a job and we moved every 6 months for 3 years. So I found this niche of filling in for people on maternity leave. I would go to big papers and I'd be like, okay, who's pregnant? I want their beat for the next, you know, whatever, 4 months, because I'm only going to be here for 6 months. It was brilliant. We went to Seattle. I worked for a paper in Seattle. Then I worked for a couple papers in and around Dallas. And then I went to Newport News, Virginia, back to Dallas. That was tough after being in Dallas and getting out of Dallas and going back. That was hard because it didn't feel like home to me. So that was a little hard. And then we landed up in Boston and I've been here ever since. So I've written for a variety of magazines and newspapers covering everything from real estate, education, police beats, environment, parenting. I wrote for a parenting magazine for a while. So yeah, I've seen it all.
What is the craziest story you ever had to cover?
When I was in Dallas, I was an education reporter in Dallas in the early 90s, and that was rough because they were trying to roll out, you know, AIDS education in schools, and there was just, they wouldn't have it. You couldn't say penis, you couldn't say sex, you couldn't say condom, you couldn't say any of these words in an AIDS curriculum, you know, trying to teach children about AIDS. So I had to cover it. And it's really hard to, you know, be objective sometimes when you see things unfolding in front of you that are it was scary and detrimental, and but you have to cover it. So I'd say it left the biggest imprint on me.
Is it a matter of being objective, or is it a matter of appearing objective, writing objective?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Appearing objective, because you have to cover what is happening. Like if you go to a school board meeting and there are people getting up and yelling things that I don't like or I don't agree with, I still have to cover what happened. But it's hard internally, especially stuff like that. And there was a lot of education stuff going on in the Dallas area at the time. And then at the same time with the same job, the Cowboys, they were floating some bonds for, you know, stadium expansions and stuff. And I got wrapped up in covering the municipal financing of some Cowboys stuff. And so I covered a lot of it and it went pretty well. And I was working for a local paper. And so I started doing some freelancing, ended up getting a job at a municipal finance newspaper, a national paper called The Bond Buyer, covering sports financing, the municipal financing of sports arenas for a while. And then from there, every time I moved, anybody who was offering me a job only wanted to offer me a job in business or finance. And that isn't what I wanted to be doing. But I got like pegged as like a municipal finance reporter. So for a while, I wrote a stock column in Boston for a while. Wow. I wrote all these, like I covered venture capital and all these things, but that wasn't what I intended to do as a journalist. It's just kind of this path that kind of unrolled in front of me. So I ended up being a finance reporter most of my career.
So we've appeared at multiple book fairs at the same time. And I'm fascinated by the novelist. And here's why I'm fascinated. If you're me, and I write a Bo Jackson book, my last book is about Bo Jackson. Well, I have sports radio. I have sports TV. I have sporting events. I have a built-in 100% lockdown fan base. It doesn't mean they will buy the book, but he played for Auburn. He's an icon at Auburn University. He played for the Royals. He played for the Raiders. He played for the Angels. And he played for the White Sox. Those are all built-in audiences. Football fans are a built-in audience. So I know exactly what I'm doing when I promote a book. I don't actually understand how one promotes a novel and gets buzz for a novel. And I know that is a loaded, fat, juicy softball I just threw at you. Being serious though, how do you do it?
I don't know how to do it either. I'm working on it. I like to hustle. Some novelists are introverts and want to sit at home and just write and make beautiful words, which I also like to do. But I don't mind hustling. I don't mind getting out there and talking to people and showing up. So I have carved out a niche for myself. It's not as big as your built-in market, but because I write all of my books have some element of climate science in the backdrop of the story. And I have a little bit of a background in that because in addition to being a journalist, I also ran an organic farm for 15 years. I've been a beekeeper. I have a sustainable agriculture certificate at Tufts. So I have a little bit of credibility, not a lot, but a little bit. But so I have created this little niche for myself of talking about the intersection of climate science and literature and more broadly about the intersection of climate science and art. So I've done events like an exhibition opening at the Dallas Museum of Art, where there was an art exhibit featuring a visual artist whose art all hinged on climate change, along with another writer who wrote about climate change. So I was the kind of the MC of the evening and could talk about these things. Giving a lecture at the University of Delaware next week. At the agriculture department. And I'm doing it in conjunction with a beekeeper because my most recent book is about a beekeeper. So I've found a market there that's a little bit different than a lot of novelists because I go on podcasts that are related to climate. I go to tons of bookstores, lots of that stuff, but I also go to museums. I go to art galleries. I go to places where people want to talk about climate. I do panels with scientists sometimes where I never pretend to be a scientist. I am not a scientist and I'm not an expert, but I do, like you, know how to do research and find the right people to talk to and bounce my work off people and vet it through other readers. So I can talk about this stuff, but I think what I bring to it is that the story, like the human elements involved in climate change and climate science, and I can put together a narrative that's going to bring in people who might not sit through a documentary about climate change, or maybe they don't want to read a 10,000 word article, but they'll read a story about human beings, relationships and emotions and stakes and suspense, and maybe get engaged a little bit, maybe think about it a little differently. So that's kind of the market I've created for myself. But that said, marketing a novel kind of stinks right now because if you're not Stephen King, you're getting a smaller and smaller piece of the pie right now. The big five publishers are putting more money behind the big names and lesser money behind fewer new names like me. So you have to really scrape. I've been really fortunate. I have a fantastic publisher at Macmillan and they've treated me really well. So I think I'm one of the luckier ones, but even that, I feel like I'm always scraping to get by, to get noticed, to get out there in front of people. It's kind of a tough racket.
One of my favorite topics is pimping a book. And how hard it is. I think it's fascinating. So when you have a book come out, like The Last Beekeeper came out earlier this year, what do you expect the publisher will do for you? And what do you assume you have to do for yourself?
I assume I have to do almost all of it myself. Now, and I say that with love for my publisher because I love my editor. She is such a good editor and I wouldn't trade her for anything. Like, she gets me and she gets my books. And my publicist, I'm the squeaky wheel at my publisher. I'm the one who will call and be like, hey, can you do this? Hey, can you send me here? Hey, can you print these for me? Can you send a poster to this bookstore? If I don't ask, those things don't often happen. If I want to go to a book festival, they sometimes will put me up, like at Tucson, when you and I met up at Tucson earlier this year at the Tucson Book Festival, they put me up for that one. But some of them, I'll call them and I'll be like, hey, I want to go to this. Can you send me out there? I also am part of two speakers bureaus that they will put me up for things. University of Delaware, I reached out. I'm like, hey, I'm an alum. I've got a book. You've got an agriculture and a literature department. Let's do this. So I do a lot of that stuff. My publisher, they do I don't want to say the bare minimum because it sounds ungrateful, but that's just how the industry is these days.
You and I were, it's kind of a humble brag, Julie. We were both at the Tucson Book Festival. We were both, marquee speakers at the Tucson Book Festival. So your publisher, and I'm not being critical of your publisher. I agree with you 100% with everything you just said. Did your publisher fly you out there?
Yeah, they paid for a book tour. Like they paid for me to go to Tucson. I went to Seattle. I went to Cleveland, Connecticut, Denver, Atlanta, and they pay for that stuff for the most part. When I'm in a city that I know somebody, I'll stay with family. Partly because I don't want to be too much of a strain on the publisher because I want them to keep doing that. And I want to perform for them. It's kind of like that. Like, I want to make mom happy. I want to produce for them because I want them to give me a new contract. I want the next book deal. I want them to see that I took the money they invested in me and did good things with it. So I ask for all the stuff. They say no sometimes, but I am a squeaky wheel. I do not wait for them to call me and say, hey, would you like to do this? Yeah, I'll send them a note and say, hey, I'd like to do this. Sometimes they say yes. Sometimes they say no.
It's kind of funny. Bo Jackson book. I was like, I don't really enjoy doing signings that much, to be honest, but I thought Alabama, big market, blah, blah, blah. So I told my publisher I want to do HarperCollins. I want to do some signings in Alabama. And they were, and I think understandably, they were like, I don't know if the bang for the buck is there for that. And they pitched in $1,000 and I arranged, or they helped arrange 4 book signings in the state of Alabama. I probably sold 500 books. And I do actually wonder, like, and I know this goes against everything we want, but like, is the bang for the buck there to send us to the Tucson Book Festival? Like, is that actually worth, is that money well spent in promoting
books? Yeah. I also think that you and I are in very different positions. So I feel like you have a much bigger established platform than I do as an author. And I'm still in the early phase of my second book just came out. My third book is due on November 1st, and I have a contract for a fourth book. So I am in the building stage. Like, I need to get my face in front of as many people as I can. I need to talk about my book. I need to engage people with the type of writing I do. There's a growing number of books that are out there kind of engaging climate science in literature. It's new-ish. And it's something that more people are doing. But I'm going to get out there and talk about it. I want people to remember, you know, my story, not just my book, but me, because I have another book coming out. I want them to buy my backlist. So I think for me, I need to get out there and do all that stuff because I'm trying to build something. I don't know if in each individual event's going to pay off, but my bet is my third book's going to be better than my second book. And I think my second book was better than my first book. And if I just keep getting out there hustling and, you know, I love what I do. I love writing. I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, I feel so lucky I get to do this. Like, I really do. Like, I absolutely feel like I'm doing exactly what I want to do. And I love that. I want to be able to continue doing that for money. So I need to get people to buy my book. So I'll get out there and hustle.
What's your smallest event you've done?
Yeah. A library in Connecticut. I think there was 8 people showed up and it was a really engaged 8 people and they were awesome. So I don't know. I'm not that cynical about that stuff because you just don't know. Sometimes, you know, I've showed up at things I thought there was going to be, you know, a handful of people and, you know, there's 115 people and I didn't expect it, or I expected 20, or I don't know. I just keep putting it out there and do what happens.
Wait, Julie, I just want you to know, when my first book came out, Mayopac Public Library, Mayopac, New York, my hometown, had me in for a signing, didn't put up a single sign about it, and there were 3 people there, my mom, my dad, and Andrew Hanahan's sister, Andrew Hanahan, who I went to high school with, and that was literally it. And I was like, what am I doing here? What's the point of this? I do feel like that moment when you walk into a room and there are 8 people, it's not the best.
Yeah. And everybody says that there's always going to be, there for every writer, no matter who you are, one day, nobody's going to show up. One day you're going to have an event and nobody shows up. So every time I have an event, I'm like, is this it? Is this the one where nobody shows up? But you want to hear like a horror story? I mean, this is just breaks my heart. So, okay. You know, the Sundance Film Festival, this was actually my husband's idea. It's like, so I had a book coming out in January, 2021 and my debut. And he's like, hey, you should do an event at Sundance. And cause it's in January, 2021. So I'm like, you know, why would anybody there want to do something for a book? It's a film thing. So Sean, my husband, is like, let's think outside the box. So he's like, call real estate companies, because during Sundance, they've got all these high name people in Park City. They want to get bodies into their real estate offices. Maybe they do events, and they do. They have like hospitality budgets. So I get this big event. It's sponsored. It's paid for. They did food, wine, custom cocktails, advertising. It was in a huge 5-star hotel. The office was, then they were going to put invitations in every single room with my picture and my book, inviting them to this book launch thing. Guess what happened in January of 2021?
A little thing called COVID?
Yeah. So they canceled it. Okay. January 22, my paperback comes out and they're so nice. They're like, hey, let's do this. It's January 22. We're good, right? Let's have a paperback launch for you. Same thing. The room, the space, paid for food, beer, wine, custom cocktails, Omicron, canceled. Okay. You think the story's over, but no, third time. The Last Beekeeper is coming out in February, or I guess it was in March, but my publisher gives permission for us to do a pre-launch at Sundance. They pay for the whole thing, everything. And it got canceled again, 3 times.
Why the third time was it canceled?
Oh, so the third time, they had cut all their hospitality staff and budget because of COVID the previous years. And at the last minute, 3 weeks before the event, they canceled it for like budgetary reasons from the, you know, and it was a free party. Nobody owes me a free party, right? So it isn't even, I mean, I would like more than 3 weeks notice because I told all these people about it. But three times, a free, huge, beautiful party at the Sundance Film Festival, rug ripped off from under me three times.
Is it possible the third time it was canceled because someone in charge was like, wait, what is this we're doing? Oh, Julie Carrick. Fucking again? Nah. No.
No, you know, the thing is that they offered it the two times after it got canceled the first time. Like, they offered to do it. They were really kind. Like, honestly, they were a pleasure to work with other than canceling the party.
Wait, I have another question for you about this all, about promoting.
Okay.
And this is not, I just want to say, I have to preface this. This is 0% criticism if it comes out that way. It's not. On your website, you list the different awards you've won, which I would do the exact same thing. Like, in their awards, you know, I don't know, the Claymore Award and the Writer's Digest contest and the Somerset Award and the Rev Pick contest and on, right? All these things, writing awards. Do writing awards mean anything to you, or is it just fodder to put?
To be honest, I have not updated my website in a long time. And I most of that stuff doesn't really matter. I've got more updated stuff I could put on there, but I mean, I'm lucky if I can like open my email. I am really bad with technology. And the woman who does my website for me, like every year, I'll be like, here, can we update this? And I'll send her stuff. Writing awards, unless it's the Pulitzer or the Nobel Prize or, you know, the National Book Award, I don't really think it matters that much. I think in the beginning, in terms of getting an agent and getting a publisher and getting a little bit of credibility, it mattered, but I don't think it matters at all anymore.
Weird question for you. Writing biographies, I always know how a book is going to begin. I know what the middle is. I know how it's going to end. Guy dies or guy retires or guy whatever. Like, it's very obvious. And I always think, like, the thing that's holding me back, I swear to God, not making this up, from writing any sort of novel, because people always ask, I'm sure you get asked questions like, oh, would you do this? Would you do that? Would you ever write a novel? Would you ever, have you ever thought about doing fiction? I don't fully understand how one ends a book. Just as an example, your last book, The Last Beekeeper, you have this book. It has a beginning. I could see a beginning. I could see a middle. The story takes you somewhere. How do you know how to end a book?
So I've had different experiences with different books. My first book, Waiting for the Night Song, I was just kind of winging it all the way through, like, and then this happens, and then this happens. And then I get to the end, and I'm like, oh, crap. I don't know what. I had 8 different endings for that book that my publisher was like, nope, send it back.
Send the ending in, and your editor would be like, nah, next ending.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, it was my agent first was like, yeah, this isn't working. And it didn't feel right to me either. It isn't like I wrote this and I was like, yes, this is so brilliant. I didn't feel right. And then when I found the ending, I knew I found it, but it took me a while to get there. And part of it is because there's a character in my first book who he was, you know, kind of like the antagonist. And I had him doing something because it worked for the plot. It wasn't true to his character. So they didn't fit. If the character and the action don't match up, it's not a satisfying ending. If it's not something that the character would do or that you could see. So I had to do a lot of like thinking deeply about like my character's nature and all that, you know, stuff. But with The Last Beekeeper, I knew exactly how that book was going to end from the moment I started it. So I wrote the whole book with the idea of building towards this moment. I knew where I was going. And so all the way through the book, I was kind of thinking like, you know, I need an earned ending. I need to earn the payout at the end. And so it was actually, to me, an exciting way to write. Some authors hate that. Some novelists don't like knowing where it's going. They want the freedom to just let it flow and go. And I think that's great if it works for you, but I need to know the ending. I've learned that now. My third book, I'm working on the second draft right now. It's due in November. And I also knew exactly how that book was going to end. I had the image of it. I knew the vibe. I knew, you know, who was going to be in the scene, what they were going to be doing, and you know what the emotional load was going to be. And the fourth book that I have under contract, which I haven't started writing, but I've done like a 10-page outline. Again, I know exactly how it's going to end. So for me, you know, it's not that different than you. Like, I know how it's going to end before I start writing.
Could you theoretically write the last chapter of your book and then go back and write the beginning, or would that be ridiculous?
No, I don't think that's ridiculous at all. If you look at the first page, maybe first paragraph or first sentence of a book, and then look at the very end of a book, I like there to be some relationship to what pulls you into a novel and how you walk out the door of a novel. Like, they need to answer some question, or even it doesn't have to be a direct question, but even if it's just an emotional question, to have answered the story question you put out to your reader in the beginning of the book. So I really like knowing what the answer is before I start writing. And, you know, if you ask 10 novelists how to do that, you get 10 different answers because everybody does it differently. But for me, it gives me clarity as I write. to know. And I change things along the way. It isn't like I know everything. I know the beginning and the ending, but I don't know all the connective tissue in between. So that's, to me, the exciting part is finding ways to get to that ending that I want to find. But yeah, I've written the end before. I've finished a book before, for sure.
When you wrap a first draft, just as an example, and then you read it over, are you more inclined to think, oh man, this is really good, I can really write? Or are you more inclined to think, God, this fucking sucks and I'm terrible and this book is never going to sell?
This sucks. It's terrible. It's never going to sell. I don't remember how to write a book and I am about to get fired from my publishing house. That's my response to the first draft of anything.
And then what changes?
I don't let anybody read the raw first draft of anything. I go through and I rewrite it. And then sometimes I find sentences that don't suck. I find an idea that was kind of interesting and I'll build on it. And it usually doesn't suck as much as I think it does. And then, you know, when I get to the revision, it for me is my favorite part of writing. I love deep revision, like the words, the language, the, you know, brevity of language and the cadence of sentences and the way they build on each other. That is my favorite part of writing. So that's what I'm doing right now. And my third book, it's not coming out to 2025. So I've got plenty of time to, you know, work on this book, but I really like it. And it's the first time I think I've been at like a second draft stage of a book that I've sort of kind of loved the book. So either I'm delusional or, you know, I don't know that that means anybody else will like it, but I'm proud of it in second draft stage. And I have not been proud of the other two in second draft stage. They were pretty sloppy. So maybe it's just the story or the message I'm trying to get across. It feels really good to me in this third book, or I'm completely wrong and it sucks. I don't know.
Or maybe you're genius.
Or I'm a genius. That's right. That's always an option. Yeah.
It's not one out there. University of Delaware education. You know.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
All right. So it's like you submit it and then the editor's like, all right, I'll have my edits back in whatever, 3 weeks. So for me, that is the worst 3 week span of my life. I hate every moment of it, every moment of it. And I actually hate getting the book back and I hate seeing the edits, but I've met people who actually enjoy it. Do you enjoy getting back a marked up manuscript by someone?
Kind of. Part of it is because I have an incredible amount of trust and faith in my agent and my editor. And they're my, you know, my agent reads it before I send it to my editor. And she read my first draft. It's like the icky draft. Both of them understand my vision. And so when they give me feedback, I never feel like they're giving me feedback that's changing my goal. It's making the book better. I don't take every single suggestion that they offer, but their vision aligns with mine for my books. And I think I'm really lucky. They don't ever try to push me in a direction that doesn't feel right. And if I push back on something, they let me. They don't try to like force me into a lane. So I love, like I had this like almost 2-hour brainstorming session with my agent a few weeks ago after she read the first draft. And she was pretty excited about the book. I think she liked it too. And her ideas just, they excited me. So I love brainstorming with someone who's read the book, who gets the book. And so I do kind of like that. Maybe that's weird, but I do sort of like getting the feedback and diving back in. Like to me, this is my favorite part right now. This is exciting to me.
I don't even recognize the person I'm talking to. And here's what I mean. For me, like you're like, I love writing. And I'm like, I love reporting. I love digging. I love the whole, you know, like I'm doing a Tupac book. Like I love going to these worlds that I never occupied. Like I love that, literally physically going to these worlds I've never occupied and whatever. Like I love that stuff. And I look forward to the writing, but I do find it torturous. And I think everything I write sucks. And there's a lot of self-loathing and health anxiety. And like, what is that twitch in my arm? And why, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you don't seem to have that.
No, I do. I just think it's a little different. Like, I think my anxieties are more about book launch stuff than book writing. Mm-hmm. I really like writing. I mean, there's moments, there are days that are really hard. I'm not going to pretend every day is just like flowers and ponies and rainbows. I have hard days. Writing The Last Beekeeper was the hardest for me. It was during the pandemic and the first draft that I turned into my editor, it was a dual timeline book. It had a timeline when my character was 11 and a timeline when they're 22. I had to rewrite the entire timeline when she was 22, the whole thing.
Like, how many words would that be? How many words did you delete?
The book was about 115,000 words. So roughly half of it, I had to toss out and start over because the setting wasn't working.
Wait. I have to ask real quick. Is there a moment when you realize, holy fuck, I have to write 60,000 words over again?
Yeah. Oh. It sucks. There were tears. I wasn't angry because I knew my editor was right. Like, I knew she was right. What happened is the book is set in the near future, and it's about the collapse of our pollinators and what happens to our economy, our politics, our food systems and everything when we lose pollinators. And so it has this dystopian vibe to it. It's just barely in the future, but I went way too far in the world building. I mean, way too far. I created a whole nother currency in the United States. I mean, I went super detailed into world building. And it wasn't spending enough time like interiority, the characters and the emotions and the story as I was about the world. And I had set it in this like city. I don't write cities well. I'm a nature girl. I need my hands in the dirt and my characters need to be near dirt, or I just am not a good writer. And I needed to get my character out of the city. It was just wasn't working. And so I had to ditch the location and my characters in the city, get her out of the city into it's closer to the dirt. And then the story just like, it blossomed from there. So the writing wasn't bad once I realized it, but it was really demoralizing when I got those notes back, which basically said, yeah, half this book is going in the garbage can.
What does it mean? I mean, you've been to cities, you lived in Boston. Yeah. Like, what does it mean? I don't do cities well.
I think I see the world in terms of nature, like I, you know, textures of trees, there's a scene in my first book, Waiting for the Night Song, where a character licks a rock to see it change color, you know, from the saliva on the granite. Mm-hmm. And people thought that was really weird. And I'm like, what, you've never licked a rock before?
I think that's really cool, actually. Yeah, I think that's cool. Yeah.
And so I think I interpret the world through, you know, the grit of dirt, the texture of tree bark, smells and tastes and things like that. And I guess I didn't know that about myself so much. And then when I was in a city and the cues around my characters were, you know, like cement walls, I couldn't access their, you know, the depths of their emotions through the descriptions I was using because I don't feel them as much. And that's just, you know, it's a limitation. I mean, it's something, ironically, I live downtown Boston in an apartment building and I'm working on that. Like, I'm sure it's something like I recognize as a weakness in my writing that I'm aware of and I'm working on it. But I also am aware now I have a strength in my writing, and that's writing in more natural settings. So, you know your strengths, know your weaknesses.
So if we see some crazy lady walking around Boston with a notepad taking notes, we know it's you.
Yeah, licking trees and rocks and all that. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, yeah.
One thing I've always been fascinated by with your genre of writing is like, I remember when you did some event and you were talking about the attachment to characters. And to be honest, there's always a part of me that's like, is that real or is that kind of bullshit? Like, so you have your main character in The Last Beekeepers is Sasha. And so you travel along this journey with Sasha. And, you know, Sasha is not a real person. She's an imagined person in your head. There is actually no Sasha in the real world.
Hey. Sasha is real.
My friend, she's right here. How, honest to God, like how real is the attachment, the emotional connection to characters? And what is it like then to be like, okay, book's done. That's it. Bye, Sasha.
I feel very strongly about the characters in The Last Beekeeper, more so than I did in my first book, and Waiting for the Night Song. It's not that I like the book better, but the characters, there's four characters in particular. They're all like 20-somethings that are kind of, you know, these disenfranchised people squatting on an abandoned farm in my book. And the relationships between these characters felt so real to me. Like, I feel like they were my friends. You know, if I had a magic wand and I would love to go sit around the campfire with them at night and just like hang out. Like, I really like them. Like, I want to be friends with these people. And I feel like I know their backstories because I invented them, but they feel very real to me. Not all characters feel that way to me. Not all of them. I don't like, I miss those characters. I miss the relationships between the four of them. Sometimes I think of things in my life and I'll be like, oh, Ian would have said this. You know, he's a made up guy. He's not real. But if Ian was here, he'd say this, or little things like that. And, I also ended The Last Beekeeper on a very ambiguous note. Like, it has, to me, a satisfying ending, but I don't answer a lot of story questions. I leave it kind of open. And I've gotten so much mail about, like, is there going to be a sequel? You know, we want to know what's happening. There is not. I'm not going to write a sequel. I want to leave it open. I want these characters to have the freedom to go live their lives. You know, I imagine what they're doing. I like keep hoping one day I'm going to end up like, you know, go to my mailbox and have a postcard from Sasha letting me know what's going on or something. But I am, this is actually a little insider info. When my paperback comes out, I'm including an epilogue because I've gotten so much feedback about people wanting to know just a few things. I'm not going to answer everything up. I don't like putting a nice neat bow on everything, but a couple of things. But yeah, those characters live in my head for sure.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my wife, Catherine. How's it going?
Casey's friend, Anna, has been here for a long time.
Ugh, I know.
She kind of smells like turpentine.
And she hears everything.
Hey, what are you guys talking about?
Oh, just RoyalRetros.com, the sponsor of my podcast.
Oh, is that the place that does throwback sports jerseys and hats and t-shirts? I love everything they make, and your podcast is dope. I listen 3 times a day. Who knew Alan Shipnuck was already working on a new book? And do you think Candace Buckner stays at the Post?
Well,
I guess she can stay.
Do you view a book more affectionately if it sells well? Like one of your two books, I'm sure you have the sales figures. I'm sure one of them sold better than the other. Does that give you any favoritism toward that book, or do sales figures at all influence, I guess, how you view the success of the book?
That is a good question, because my first book, Waiting for the Night Song, definitely sold better than The Last Beekeeper. Trying to be as objective as I can, I think The Last Beekeeper is a significantly better book. I think it's the writing is better. I think the story is better. I think the premise is, you know, fresh. And I think it's a better book. It just is. And for whatever reasons out there in the, you know, the market, whatever that is, it didn't sell as well. It's fine. You know, it's doing okay. It's still out there. I'm still, you know, I've got 2 book events next week. I'm heading to Houston the week after that. And I've got 2 book events in October. So it's still out there. It's still moving. I still get a lot of requests, but it's not selling as well, but it's my favorite for now. I will tell you the book I'm working on right now. Like, I love this book so much. It's so weird, Jeff. It's so freaking weird. And I love it to pieces. So maybe that'll be my new favorite. I don't know.
Is it about a bunch of pimply adolescents eating sloppy pizza in a Delaware student newspaper office and sleeping?
No, that's the next book. But I don't know. So I no worries if you haven't, but if you haven't read Waiting for the Night Song, there is a bar in Waiting for the Night Song. I'm going to give you 3 guesses. What's the name of the bar?
Stone Balloon.
Keep going.
Deer Park.
Deer Park. Yeah. That was the University of Delaware Wednesday night nacho night bar. So I throw Easter eggs in there.
Very nice.
But yeah.
I make Delaware references in every book. I make Delaware references, hometown references, family references. Every book I try to throw a few.
Yeah. In my Waiting for the Night Song, I'm sorry, in The Last Beekeeper, there's this little subplot of people sharing books. Like, you know, there's like a used bookseller at this market and they're always recommending and trading books with each other. And I made up the titles. They're not real books. Like, I could have used real books, but I like made up titles of books. And my copy editor called me and they're like, you know, I was checking these books. These are not real books. And I was like, I know every one of those books is an anagram of my children's names.
I love that.
And my kids' names anagram brilliantly, like such good anagrams. And I obviously did not think of that when I named them. But so all the books that made up titles are my kids' names with the letters mixed up.
Now, here's a good question for you.
Yeah.
Do your kids give a shit?
Yes, they do. Yeah, they're great. They come to my events. Okay, so if you're a parent, you'll appreciate this. So I have a daughter who lives in Denver, and I did a book event in Denver. So obviously she came, and it was a pretty well attended, nice event. And at the end of the event, when I'm, you know, wrapping up the Q&A and everything, my daughter, like unprompted, just stands up, walks up to the front of the room, opens this package and unfurls a blanket. It was a hand crocheted blanket of a beehive. And it was spectacular. Like, I mean, I would have paid a lot. She's really talented. This is not like a little arts and craft project. My daughter's in her 20s. But they've been really engaged in just really cool ways, getting their friends involved. They show up to stuff. They share my stuff on social media. And I hesitate to say it, but I think they're proud of me.
You know, Julie, I'm just going to be honest with you. So I had a book become a TV show. And
I know.
Until that happened, I don't think my kids gave a shit. And then I was cool for about a week. And that was really fun. And now I don't think they're going to give a shit again. I think part of it is, honestly, like, you've come to this a little later than I have. And like, literally, I've been writing books about athletes and such since kids were infants. So I think it's probably just normal.
I think part of it too, you're right. Like, I was doing other stuff but they saw me like slaving away. They saw me getting rejections and rejections and then getting up and fighting and keep going and getting more rejections and keep going. They saw me in the trenches fighting for it. And then when I finally got it, they knew it mattered. Also, I write novels and the kids are like, my son does not read fiction. He is a nonfiction guy for sure. He even read it I think that was painful for him to have to read it. But my girls really like the genre fiction I write. Like, I think if I didn't write it, they might like my books and those books anyway. So it's a little bit of an easier sell for me because those are books my kids like. So that makes it a little easier, probably.
I have a question I wasn't going to ask you, but I'm going to throw it at you.
Okay.
Do you think I should be insulted that my mom, who doesn't care anything about sports, has never read any of my books?
I don't think my dad's read my books. I mean, he's super. Yeah. My dad's super proud of me. But I don't think he's not a fiction reader, like, but he's really proud of me. Like, you know, I'm doing a book event in Maryland next week and my mom and dad are coming. They're bringing their friends. I'm going to be so well represented from the retirement home where my parents live at this event. My dad hasn't read my books and that's okay with me. So I don't think you should be insulted.
I know it sounds cornball, but I just love that we both worked at this little small newspaper at this relatively not anonymous, but it's not Harvard, you know, college. And like seeing you in Tucson was like a thrill. I thought, oh, this is so cool. It really jazzed me up. You know, like I like seeing people from our little, you know, again, like not that anyone gives a shit, but University of Delaware student newspaper, The Review, we came out twice a week. It was back in the day when you would like, you know, we'd be there till 3 in the morning. The couch was orange. The pizza sucked and people would be smoking in the back or like whatever. And like, it was a grind. Like that was... It was a great.
But it was awesome. It was an awesome time though. You know, I went back to The Review in the fall this year. And this is a little bit of a sad story. And I'm sorry if I'm the one that's telling you this during an interview, but I don't know if you remember John Robinson. He was on the paper, but he passed away. Yeah. And so a bunch of us, because I was really close with John. We actually lived together for a while with a bunch of us. And when he passed away, it was during the pandemic. And so he lived in Boston here near me. And I saw him and I knew his wife. And it was really sad. And a bunch of us wanted to get together after the pandemic was over to kind of honor him. So we all had a memorial for John in the Deer Park, like just a handful of us, not a lot, just a few of us got together. We called the editor of The Review that went before we were coming. We're like, can we come up and see The Review? And she took us on a tour of The Review and we went back and looked. Remember those big, huge bound copies? Issue.
Of course.
We put them out on the floor. We were laughing so hard. Like, I'm surprised we didn't all pee our pants. We were like looking at these crazy editorials we wrote and these articles that we thought was like so important about the new dorm renovations, you know? But it was a really good, those were good memories. Like all of you guys were like part of I feel like those memories take up a bigger place in my brain, you know, like disproportionate to the amount of time I knew you all. You know what I mean? Like those memories are big and they mattered a lot to me. So it's a good memories we share.
What's your craziest college newspaper memory / moment?
I don't know. To me, it wasn't about the stories of the paper. It was about like all of you. It was about the people, the relationships, the rush of a deadline that I thought was so important. Like this was everything mattered that I got this article in and to get an article on the front page, like when I was first starting out as like a, you know, journalism, what E307 or something was called at class when you get one of your assignments gets in the paper. To be perfectly honest, that thrill was bigger to me than what I was writing about. It was the people I was with and being part of this team. To this day, that group of people, I feel like is one of the most important groups or teams I've ever been a part of. It's just of having a common goal and like believing in it. Like we were drinking the Kool-Aid, like the religion of college journalism. We were all in and you know, it was, I don't know, it was just a pretty magical time, but I don't think there was a journalism moment.
You remember Chuck Stone, Professor Chuck
Stone? Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
So I had him as a professor my freshman year, and he was just a joy. I mean, a joy, the late Chuck Stone. And
he was amazing.
Amazing. And at the end of that year, he appeared on a radio show on the college radio station in Delaware. And he started talking about me, some story I wrote. And I mean, I don't know if I've ever had a high since that's even close to hearing Chuck Stone. You're a freshman at Delaware, and you think all this stuff is so insanely important. And this guy is talking about, I remember Chuck Stone, he goes, and that's my student. Oh. And I was like, oh my God.
You know? He's a legend. I mean, legend. In journalism, not just as a great professor, but like as just a legend in the DC journalism scene during the civil rights. That's a good memory. I don't think I have one like that.
All right. I'm going to throw some randos at you. Are you ready?
Okay. I'm ready.
Your mom ran a puppet theater when you were a kid.
Yeah. My mom ran a puppet theater. So she was the first storyteller that like inspired me. I used to write stories for her puppet. My first publishing credit, if you want to call it that, was I wrote a play, a script for her puppet theater when I was 10. And she was a great storyteller. I mean, even just like bedtime stories. I know everybody thinks their mom's a great storyteller. My mom was like the best storyteller. And I think that's what made me want to tell stories in the first place. I was writing stories ever since I was a kid. I mean, I didn't start publishing fiction until I was an adult, but I was always writing it. And I'm working on a middle grade novel too. I didn't tell you about that, but it's inspired by my parents, actually.
I feel like I need to go back to puppet theater. Was this a for-profit puppet theater?
The Lollipop Puppet Theater. And on weekends, I would go around with my mom's. I was her behind the scenes, you know, like puppet things. She actually even made some of the puppets. Like, she was really talented. My mom's really creative. And I would be back there doing, and then I'd have to go out and like hand out a lollipop to every freaking kid. This is me in elementary school. Like, I want to go home and go ride my bike, you know, and I'm like handing out lollipops to kids at like puppet shows. But it was fun. I mean, and I lived in Europe for a while when I was a kid, until I was 8. And she used to do puppet, you know, events. And there's a whole nother side of the story, which would be a whole topic for another podcast someday. But my parents were both U.S. intelligence agents, which is why I grew up in Europe and during the Cold War. And so that was just, the puppet thing was just like a side gig.
Yeah, I don't want to brag. My dad was an accountant. So also exciting. Also pretty exciting.
Very exciting.
All right, wait, you wrote, as a kid, you would write fan fiction scripts of Mork and Mindy.
Oh, brilliant. Good stuff. But the best ones were like Charlie's Angels too. I did Charlie's Angels, Mork and Mindy, and Wonder Woman were like the three I like to do fan fiction. But even worse, I used to make my friends act them out with me. Somehow I had friends. I was the nerdiest of all.
I'm thinking like, really? You had friends? That's like...
I know. Yeah, you wouldn't think so, kid who did that. But I had friends, and we would go out in the woods with walkie-talkies and not just act out, but like live out the Charlie's Angels scripts. Like, we wouldn't just act them out in like front of an audience. We would disperse into the woods and act out the episodes. It was brilliant.
I'm going through some old stuff here. You dated a Russian mafioso, true or false?
Yeah, that's true. At Delaware, I did a semester in Russia.
Okay.
Yeah. Things happened.
Was he actually a Russian mafioso?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't know that, in my own defense, in the beginning.
Okay. You met Desmond Tutu?
I did. Yeah. The day after graduation in 1992, literally the morning after I graduated, I got on a plane. I flew to South Africa and I was there for the summer. And I was staying on the couch of this woman in Cape Town for a while. And she was talking about Desmond this and Desmond that, like her friend Desmond. And I'm like, oh, who's this? She's like, you know, Desmond Tutu. I'm like, you're friends with Desmond Tutu? She's like, yeah, you want to meet him? And she called him and went over and hung out with Desmond Tutu. And it was in 1992. So it was like right after apartheid was coming undone. And he invited us to this ceremony where the very first time that a piece of land owned by like white Afrikaners in South Africa was voluntarily given back to the original black landowners. And it was a ceremony, and that was that day. And he invited us to, and it was a private ceremony. It was actually really amazing to have been there to see, you know, this white man who had lived his whole life in South Africa as this rich landowner in the wake of, you know, the collapse of apartheid, voluntarily giving his family's land back. It was pretty moving.
So you've seen some shit.
I've seen some shit. Yeah.
I have two final questions here. Number one,
okay.
You write a lot about climate change realities and sort of the future of climate change. And the subject makes me feel like hiding under a desk. And I'm not just saying that, like the subject makes me feel like hiding under a desk. And I feel like there's a reality here, which is we're just not doing enough. We're not going to do enough. We are, as a species, in many ways, a parasite on this planet. And if it's not 2 inches in front of our face, we don't do anything about it. And it's just from the glaciers to the fires, I don't know how you keep your sanity. Like, to me, writing about Bo Jackson, if nothing else, is an escape from Trump, is an escape from climate change, an escape. And you're right in it. How do you not want to just cry yourself to sleep every night?
It's actually the reverse of this, of what you're thinking. I'm already stewing over it. I think about it a lot. Like I told you, I ran an organic farm in New Hampshire for almost 15 years. And that's what started me on this path. Is I started doing research about the land I was working on and how our growing season had been expanded by 22 days because the temperatures had gone up so much in the past century, and it just snowballed. So I'm thinking about all this stuff. And then of course I'm reading the newspaper and, you know, living on planet Earth and seeing it, but I'm thinking about it. It's in my head. So it's just manifesting. And so these are the stories that I'm thinking about. These are the characters. And I guess like when you write about something scary, it's almost like performing therapy on yourself a little bit. Like you're getting all your fears out and you're like putting them in front of you. Like in The Last Beekeeper, it's not pretty. I mean, we've lost the pollinators. So we go into like food crisis and agricultural collapse, which leads to economic and political insecurities. It's like scary stuff. But I was already thinking about it, putting it in a book and having different characters respond differently to it gives me this way of thinking about like, how would I respond in this situation, and looking at different characters respond differently. Like not all my characters are good, you know, and even the good characters do bad things and the bad characters do good things. So I think it's like kind of, you know, my form of performing therapy on myself. My climate anxieties fester for a little while and then they manifest themselves into books. So instead of it making me crazy, maybe it makes me saner because it lets me kind of process the things I'm thinking about at night.
Do you see any hope that we figure this shit out in any reasonable way?
Not in a way that fixes things. I think we can make things better than they could be. I don't think we ever go back and it's going to get worse. But what I think is people aren't acknowledging it, like you said, and we're not making responsible decisions to adapt, which is something we needed to be doing. I don't know about the area where you live, but like I live in Boston. This is a city that's, you know, vulnerable. I look at Florida, New Orleans. Would I rebuild? I wouldn't. And I mean, I'm saying this as a person, like I don't live in New Orleans. I don't live in Florida or, you know, somewhere like in the wildfire zones in California. But like, I feel like we need to be making really big decisions, and people make personal decisions. People are like, this is my home. I want to stay here. But we need to be thinking bigger and adapting to what our future is going to look like. We can do things to mitigate. There are still things we can do. But I think we also need to be thinking about how are we going to adapt in the future. And the biggest challenge, or the biggest fear, I guess I have, is there's so many inequalities already, and it's going to exacerbate all of them. It already is. I mean, if you look at where the people who are hit most by, and the first and worst by climate change is mostly marginalized communities. It's Black, Brown, Indigenous communities. It's island nations. They're hit first. They didn't cause the problem for the most part, and they're paying for it first and worst. And we need to be thinking about that kind of stuff. We need to make better conscious decisions of how we're going to live on this planet in the future, knowing it's going to be a little bit different, as well as trying to, you know, head off making it the worst case scenarios. And I don't have any of the answers, by the way. I just have a lot of fear and a little bit of hope.
All right. Final question.
Okay.
Again, you and I were about the same age. We started the same place in a lot of ways, you know, student newspaper. Yeah. We're in the same office doing the same stuff. I find aging jarring. You and I were literally young at the same place at the same time. And I think when you're young and you're coming up, in a way, you're fooled to think you're always going to be young. Like you're young. You're the young journalist. Oh, look, the new guy at the door, the new woman at the job. She's so young and she's so promising. And then you get married and you're the young couple. And then you're young and you have young kids and, oh, the babies, oh, at the park and at the play gym, you're young and you're, and then one day you kind of open your eyes and you're us, you know, like
our
50s. I know that this helmet has nothing to do with journalism, but I think about it a shitload. Like, are you comfortable with it? Or do you find it as jarring as I find it jarring? Or do you just kind of roll with it and whatever?
I mean, physically there's stuff I can't ignore, you know, like health, stupid stuff. And also, by the way, as you are thinking about this, just be glad you don't have to go through menopause. That's a whole nother next level shit. But like, I don't know, in my head, I'm still 28. I always will be. Like, I sometimes walk by a storefront mirror and I see myself and I'm like, wait, who's that old lady? Cause like inside my head, I'm like, I'm still 28. I don't know. There's like the physical stuff is super annoying, you know, but I don't feel as old as I think I should feel. And I'm not saying like I'm not aging, but I don't know.
I recorded another episode for my future episode of this podcast before, and the writer was 31 and he kept referring to me as an OG. And I was like, in my head, I'm thinking, that's not the compliment you think it is.
You know? That's funny. Yeah. I don't know. I just, I don't know. Here we are, you know, feel like I've earned all the wrinkles. I don't know. I put in my time. And I also think you get to I don't know if it's different with men or women. I don't know. But I get to this point where like, I don't really give a shit what people think about me the way I used to. 100%. I mean, as a writer, I want you to like my books. I want you to buy my books. But that's not me. That's my product. But, you know, just like stuff like, all right. Yeah, I'm going to wear my yoga pants to the grocery store and I don't care what anybody thinks. You know, I don't have like I've kind of gone over the, you know, not giving a fuck anymore. I've crossed that bridge and it's awesome over here.
It is the best part of aging is definitely realizing that these things don't matter. If someone walks away, I used to be like, oh, is that person mad at me? And now I'm like, eh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And even the writing stuff, I think if I get a review, I don't like, I feel like I don't like it. You know, it hurts my feelings no matter what. No matter what I say, it hurts a little bit when you get a bad review or something like that. But it doesn't hurt me the way I think it would have when I was younger. Maybe now I don't wrap up my identity in what I do so much. Like I'm like, okay, this is my book and then this is me. And they're not the same thing, where I think I would not have felt that way when I was younger. Like with my journalism, like I think if people criticized when I was younger in a journalism, people criticized my work, I felt like they were criticizing me. And I took it way more personally and internalized and I stewed over it much more than I do now.
Well, Julie, live from your prison cell. I'm glad we finally got to do this. I very much appreciate it. I'm a fan of your career, admirer of your career. And I envy your ability to come up with an ending to a story. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, right back at you. And I also am really grateful we've gotten a chance to kind of connect as adults because we never knew each other in the time between. We were kids. And now we're in our 50s and I never knew you in between. So it's been a real pleasure to kind of reconnect on the book tour trail.
Oh, thank you so much. I want to thank today's guest, Julie Carrick-Dalton, for joining me on Two Riders Singing Yang. And follow Julie on Instagram at Julie C. Dalton and visit her website, juliecarrickdalton.com. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really grateful. Music is by the exceptional MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep writing.